Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Russia's position between Europe and Asia has led to differing conceptions of what Russia is to its leaders. Russia's vast holdings east of the Urals have often inspired those who led Russia to look eastward for national glory, whether through trade, soft power, or outright force. Yet these Russian pivots to Asia often ended soon after they began, with outcomes far more limited than what those who launched them hoped to achieve. Professor Chris Miller's We Shall Be Masters, Russian Pivots to East Asia from Peter the Great to Putin, studies many attempts to chart an Asian policy, from bold imperial dreams of a thriving Russian Far East to Soviet efforts to inspire the developing world through soft power, and why all these policies ended up disappointing their drafters. Chris Miller is assistant professor of international history at the Fletcher School at Tufts University and co-director of the school's Russia and Eurasia program. He is the author of Putinomics, Power and Money in Resurgent Russia, and The Struggle to Save the Soviet Economy. He has previously served as the associate director of the Brady Johnson Program at Grand Strategy at Yale, a lecturer at the New Economic School in Moscow, a visiting researcher at the Carnegie Moscow Center, a research associate at the Brookings Institution, and as a fellow at the German Marshall Fund's Transatlantic Academy. Today, Chris and I will talk about Russia's engagement with the Far East, stretching from its initial forays on the Pacific coast of North America through to the present day. We'll talk about why pivots to Asia are so hard, both for the Russians and perhaps for other great powers considering the same policy. So, Chris, thank you so much for joining me today. My first question, I think, concerns geography. And in short, if you were looking at a modern map, where would you find the regions you talk about in We Shall Be Masters?
Well, thanks, Nicholas. That's a great place to start the discussion. I came to this book wanting to write a history of Russia's relations with Asia. And one of the first issues that I had to deal with is understanding, well, what does this term mean? And I guess today we're in the midst of a similar debate about what is Asia. There's this new phrase, the Indo-Pacific, that's gained in popularity. And this definitional question is quite important. In the Russian context, there's a number of different terms that refer to countries that one might describe as being in Asia. And the popularity of these terms and concepts has risen and fallen over time. There's the word Asia, Asia, in Russian, which has a similar geographic connotation to the way Asia might sound to an English-speaking person today. But there's also other words that have been relevant in the past and are relevant today. One is the concept of the East, Vostok, which sort of today and over the past 150 or so years has had the meaning of what the Orient might have meant in English-speaking usage 100 years ago or even 50 years ago, referring to a much broader array of countries, not only those on the Pacific Rim, but in some ways stretching in Russian usage from the Balkans all the way to the Pacific Ocean, which is a much broader use than the word Asia. And then there's a third term that matters a lot in Russian discourse as well, and that's the Far East, Dalny Vostok, which refers more specifically to territories that are bordering the Pacific Ocean, countries like Japan, Korea, and perhaps most importantly, China. From my perspective, there were different drivers of Russian relations with these different concepts. Certainly the drivers of Russia's relations with the Balkans, although it might fit under the Russian terminology of the East or the Orient, was fundamentally different than what was driving Russia's relations with China or Japan. And it seemed to me that there were some striking similarities between what was motivating Russia when it related to countries on the Pacific Ocean. And above all, those were similarities of geography. So it seemed to me that the way to start the book was to group the Pacific Ocean powers together, look at China, look at Japan and Korea, but also a couple of external powers that have played a big role in shaping power balances on the Pacific coast. And in particular, that would be the United States and Britain in the 19th and 20th centuries.
So interestingly, your book doesn't actually start in Asia at all, but in North America, detailing kind of Russia's efforts in Alaska, California, and I guess most surprisingly to me, Hawaii. Why start there?
Well, if you think of how Russia arrived on the shores of the Pacific Ocean, it was in a very different way than most other European powers. Most European powers that ended up in the Pacific Ocean sailed there via the oceans. So they would send ships around the Cape of Good Hope or through the Atlantic Ocean down south of South America. Russia was different. It was never a great naval power in the 18th century, in the 19th century. But what it was doing was expanding across the Eurasian continent through Siberia into the Arctic North and the northeast of the Eurasian landmass. And what that meant was that Russia reached the Arctic Ocean far ahead of when it reached the Pacific Ocean. And in fact, many of the earliest Russians to have reached the Pacific Ocean reached it from the Arctic Ocean because the great rivers of Siberia flow north into the Arctic. And so those are the paths by which Russian explorers transited. And so what that meant was that Russia's first settlements in the Pacific of any sort of substance were actually really Arctic settlements rather than Pacific settlements. And it wasn't of much import to the Russians who were there in the 19th century, whether they were on the North American side or the Eurasian side, because in fact, these settlements are really not that far apart. And so if you want to understand how Russia expanded its presence on the Pacific overall, you've actually got to look at Russia expanding its power from the north further to the south. And so the first great and important project along these lines was the attempted colonization of Alaska in the 19th century. Americans often think about the Russian presence in Alaska as being something that was focused solely on Alaska. But from the perspective of Russians who were building the presence in Alaska, and it was never a large presence, but from their perspective, Alaska was just a stepping stone to potential further expansion. They were driven by the fur trade, which is a very lucrative business at the time, but also driven by broader geopolitical goals, in a sense that the North Pacific was a territory in the 19th century that was up for grabs. And the challenge of Alaska was that there were plentiful furs, and it was easy enough to ship the furs from Alaskan waters to Chinese ports, where they fetched a very high value. But feeding your colony in Alaska was always a challenge, which is why from the earliest days of the settlements in Alaska, there was an attempt to open trade with California, then a Spanish colony, or to find new sources of produce. And one of the places that Russian mariners often stopped while transiting the Pacific was on the islands of Hawaii, then under the control of two different kings. And they realized, as many people at the time realized, that the Hawaiian Islands were perfectly situated for trade in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and also had abundant resources. And so there was a point in the early 19th century when there were Russians very seriously thinking about a trans-Pacific Russian empire that would stretch from the Russian coast and the port of Ochotsk, which is on the Russian Pacific, across to Alaska, and then south to California and Hawaii. And if you look at the trade routes and the routes by which ships sailed at the time, this was far from an outlandish scheme. In hindsight, it looks absurd, but in fact, if you're going to travel across the Pacific, these were largely natural places to stop, particularly given the importance of the fur trade and the transit of pelts to China. And so there really was a moment in the 1810s and 1820s when it seemed as though Russia might be a dominant, if not the dominant power in the North Pacific, in part because it was very early in trying to establish a foothold in these really important ports in the North Pacific.
So obviously the biggest other power in Asia, although obviously its power waxes and wanes, is China, and especially Imperial China. And the relationship between Imperial Russia and Imperial China kind of is a central part of much of the history that you talk about in your book. But how did Russia's relations with China compare to the relations of other quote unquote Western powers with China?
Well, it's interesting. On the one hand, the Russians always saw China as being distinct from the European great powers that it had relations with. The methods of diplomacy were different. The frequency of diplomacy was certainly different, simply because of the logistics of getting messages sent across the Eurasian landmass. But we know that the Russian government and the Chinese government had relations that dated back to the 1600s. And had been in regular intercourse commercially, politically, intellectually, even for several centuries before the present day. And so there was this really deep relationship between the two powers, even though from the perspective of Europeans at the time, they seemed sort of on opposite sides of the world. You traveled to Russia from Europe by going across Europe, and you traveled to China by sailing across the oceans. But from the Russian perspective and from the Chinese perspective, it was simply an overland journey. And it was a long journey that involved transiting Mongolian lands via camel caravans. It wasn't an easy journey, but it was something that had been undertaken for many decades. And so from the perspective of Moscow and the perspective of Beijing at the time in under the Qing Empire, the relationship was nothing new. It was something that had been a mix of competition and cooperation. There was always relatively extensive trade, even though there was at the same time from both powers an interest in probing weaknesses and seeing where a territory could be grabbed or advantage could be gained. And so when you look at the competition between Russia and China in the 19th century, which is something that the book focuses on, you can't really understand that, I think, without putting it in perspective of the previous couple hundred years, which is to say that this is nothing new, that these two great Eurasian empires were always colliding, interacting, and trying to gain advantage over one another. I think one difference between Russia's relations with Western powers, European powers, and China was an intellectual one, which is that particularly in the 18th and 19th centuries, the Russian elite was extraordinarily Europeanized. They would speak French. They would vacation in the south of France or in the Swiss Alps. And so more so than any other point in Russian history, the Russian elite in the 18th and 19th century was a European elite. And of course, that created an even greater gulf between where the Russian elite was in terms of thinking about foreign policy questions and where the Chinese leadership was coming from very different intellectual starting points. So that is an important difference. But I think even then, some of the there's a lot of unexpected interlinkages between Russia, Europe, and China. One of my favorites is one of the early treaties in the 17th century negotiated between the Russians and the Chinese was actually translated by a Jesuit priest who was advising the Qing government. And was one of the few people who could speak and write in a language that was both comprehensible to Chinese leaders and Russian leaders. So although there was a vast gap in terms of how Russians and Chinese at the time saw the world, there nevertheless were a lot of similarities that sometimes even ran through Europe.
And then the other, I think, kind of big relationship in Asia, at least involving the Russians, is the relationship between Russia and Japan. Obviously, as your book notes, Russia takes a keen interest in opening up Japan, and that doesn't quite work out. And then they start trying to compete for influence in Northeast Asia with Japan. That also doesn't quite work out, coming to a head in the Russo-Japanese War in 1905. I guess kind of looking throughout the book, kind of how do you see the relationship between Russia and Japan developing over this period of history?
Well, I think one striking point is that the amount of interrelationships between Russia and China has always been vastly more than the linkages between Russia and Japan. That's true historically. It's true today. And for most of the history recounted in the book, all the way up until the middle of the 19th century, the biggest challenge Russians faced was trying to visit Japan or learn anything about Japan at all. The book starts with the example of a Japanese castaway named Dembe, who became who's a sake trader, whose ship was cast out to sea and accidentally landed in Kamchatka and was taken all the way to Moscow and met Peter the Great, which is I think a fun anecdote to underscore some of the connections. But the reality is that actually the key challenge for the Russians was trying to get into Japan in the first place. And just as many of the European powers, the United States, was trying to quote unquote open Japan to trade in the 19th century, the Russians were doing the same thing, and they'd been trying even longer than many European powers. And so it wasn't until you had the big domestic political shifts in Japan in the middle of the 19th century and the decision to open up to the outside world that Russia really began to understand what was occurring inside of Japan. And I think the dilemma that Russia faced is that it had treated Japan for so long as a country that had lagged behind technologically, economically, et cetera, that in the late 19th century, it couldn't update its assumptions about Japan rapidly enough to take into account the rise of Japanese power in the latter decades of the 19th century. The victory of Japan over China in the Sino-Japanese War was something that Russia didn't take all that seriously. And so as in the at the end of the 19th century, in the early decades, the 20th century, as Russia was pushing its empire further into China, grabbing Chinese territory, building railroads through China's Manchuria, Russia didn't take Japan's views on the issue seriously at all. It didn't take Japan's threats seriously either. And so as a result of this incomprehension of Japanese power, Russia found itself in 1904, 1905, in a disastrous war with Japan, which of course it lost in the end. And so I think it's important to see the Russia-Japan relationship both as a contentious relationship throughout history, which it certainly has been, but also as a relationship far more so than the Russia-China relationship, based on a lack of understanding and a surprisingly not deep reserve of knowledge about Japan in Russia. And that's something that's persisted for some time, and I would argue persists in many ways to this day.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, one thing that kind of struck me on reading the book, especially, let's say, around the reign of Tsar Nicholas II, they seem very worried about yellow peril. They seem very worried about, I guess, having large populations of Asians in the Russian Far East, I guess, overthrowing the government. I mean, in some, Tsar Nicholas seems to have says a lot of not great things about Asian societies, Asian people. Mm-hmm. So I guess kind of in your view, did, and if they did, how did these kind of prejudices about race affect how Russia related with Asian powers during this time?
Yeah, it's a tricky question, I think, to fully answer, in part because the discourse of the yellow peril, which really peaked in Russia in, I would say, around the 1890s, but has been present before and after in to different degrees, always had a fundamental contradiction at the center of it, which is that on the one hand, there was a sense of peril, i.e. that Russian power was at risk, Russian sovereignty was at risk, combined with this sense of Russian superiority over its neighbors in Asia, the Japanese, the Chinese, and others. And this is a hard set of views to hold simultaneously, that you're both superior, but also in peril. And certainly there were different iterations of this ideology present among different Russians, and it changed over time. But I think it is striking looking back at sort of how hard it is to understand the roots of the yellow peril discourse in Russia, looking at objective factors. It's hard to understand what they were particularly afraid of. Certainly there were a large number of people in China and a smaller number of people in Siberia. But of course, the Russians technologically in the latter part of the 19th century were far ahead of where China was in many ways. And the Chinese were angry about certain territorial changes that Russia had made in the middle of the 19th century, but had bigger problems to deal with than with Russia. So in some ways, I'm struck looking back at the irrationality of the yellow peril discourse above all. But I think it is fair to say that that there certainly was a deterioration in certain Russian leaders' ability to accurately assess international politics in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, because of these racial prejudices. And I think the best example of this is Tsar Nicholas II, the last Tsar, who plunged Russia into the war with Japan, I think in no small part because he was fundamentally unable to take the Japanese seriously as a political force or a military power. And I think part of the explanation for that is certainly in the many mistakes that he made and just his general ineptitude as a czar. But I think part of the explanation also stems from his prejudices that he developed over the course of his education and his childhood. Nicholas II is interesting because he's the Russian leader who, of all Russian leaders up to that point or since then, has had actually the most experience in Asian countries. He was sent by his father, the Tsar, for a grand tour of Asia before he became the Tsar. And unlike most European princes who would do a grand tour and visit Florence and Venice and study the great works of the Renaissance, Nicholas's father, I think, somewhat wisely said, "You need to understand this other part of the world that borders us, Asia." But Nicholas's travels across Asia, from India to Southeast Asia to China and Japan, certainly didn't improve his understanding of these countries much at all, and if anything, only intensified his sense of prejudice against them.
So then, kind of the big, you can call it a big transition point, I feel like, for Russia's relations with Asia, as then you again bring up your book, is the Russian Revolution and the launch of the Soviet Union. Although now that I've asked this question and thinking through your book, actually it changed a little bit, but doesn't quite go all the way and reverts back to form. I guess, how then does the launch of the Soviet Union then change kind of Russia's attitude towards Asia?
Well, there's one big and obvious way that it changed things, which is that the Tsarist government, insofar as it had a guiding ideology, it was a guiding ideology that mattered only for Russians, about respecting the Tsar and upholding the existing social system, whereas the Soviet Union always had a ideology that it thought was globally relevant of communist revolution. And at first in the Soviet Union, the sense was that this ideology was primarily useful in Europe, because kind of the simple version of the story is that Marx had taught that you need a working class in order to have a revolution, and Europe had the world's most developed working classes. In Asia at the time, outside of Japan in particular, there weren't very developed working classes. Most people were peasants, so Asia seemed less ripe at first for revolution. But after the earliest couple of years of Soviet power in the 1910s and 1920s, when it became clear that all of Europe wasn't going to going to be overturned by communist revolutionary forces. Russians began to turn back to Asia as the czars had before, as a place where they could exercise influence internationally, and also as a place where they could push against European empires that were still present in Asia in the 1920s and 1930s. And so in some ways, the tactics were new, the tactics of starting up communist political parties, trying to spread ideology, most notably in China, where the Soviet Union played an absolutely fundamental role in the establishment of the Kuomintang and the establishment of the Chinese Communist Party, which is historically somewhat ironic, given that those two parties found themselves at odds for much of the middle of the 20th century. But the tactics that the Soviets used were new tactics that were that stemmed from the Soviet Communist Party's experience fighting the czars. So establishing secretive party cells, trying to find ways to smuggle arms across borders. This is revolutionary politics rather than great power politics as the czars practice. But even in the period where the Soviet Union was trying to spark a revolution in China in the 1920s and to some extent in the 1930s, there was a real sense as well in which this was a continuation in some ways of czarist Russian policy. And of course, the Russian Revolution might have been a revolution about international communism, but it was implemented largely by Russians. And so many of the prejudices and the assumptions that were present in late Tsarist Russia carried over naturally into early Soviet Russia. And so now, as we look as 100 years have passed on Soviet efforts to spark revolution in China in the 1920s and 1930s, I think what's really striking is not the extent to which Soviet efforts were new, all of the tactics were updated for the times, but rather the extent to which they actually fit in this broader pattern of Russian interest in China and other borderlands, and attempts to expand Russia's influence in these territories as a means of bolstering Russian power on the world stage.
So now, kind of looking at this whole history, Russia's attitude towards Asia seems very changeable. It's expansionist at times. Russia sees itself as an Asian power. At others, it's passive and disinterested, seeing itself as a European power. Sometimes this happens within the same, within the same period of leadership. So the same leader will have these same thoughts throughout his rule of Russia or the Soviet Union. So I guess, why is Russia's approach to Asia so changeable?
Yeah, well, I think one of the key things that is crucial to realize is just how far Russia's own Asian territories, the territory that Russia calls the Russian Far East along the Pacific Ocean, is from Moscow. It's a 7 or 8 hour flight from Moscow to the easternmost portions of Russia. And in the times before there were planes and before there were even trains, it was a days or months long trek. And so this logistical factor matters hugely and has mattered hugely throughout history. It matters because it's hard to get military forces from the center of Russia to Russia's Asian territories. It's difficult to control politics along Russia's Asian borderlands because they're so far from Moscow. And so there's always been a bit of sensitivity in Moscow about whether they've got a strong hold on local politics in the area. And there's also, no less importantly, been a less understanding in Moscow of countries in Asia, Japan, China, etc., than there has been of Russian understanding of countries in Europe, simply because a far smaller share of the Russian elite has spent time or studied countries in Asia. So there's much less depth of understanding. When you combine this logistical issue, which has always been present, never been resolved, with the intellectual worldview of a Russian elite that is still very much tied into Europe, thinks of itself, even when they're angry at the Europeans, they think of themselves in the same context as Europe's elite. These have been two very powerful factors that have limited Russia's ability to exert power in Asia over the long run. And so what you find is bursts of enthusiasm, periods of intense effort driven by a specific czar or a specific ruler where they want to focus on Asia. And at that time, because of the way Russia is and has historically been governed, where the leader at the top has a strong ability to shape foreign policy priorities, it's possible when they're focused on Asia to devote a large number of resources to the region and to focus foreign policy on those questions. But the natural tendency of the Russian bureaucracy, of the Russian elite, is to devote most of their energy towards European affairs. That's a tendency strengthened by the logistical factors I mentioned and strengthened also by the intellectual assumptions that I mentioned. And so what this means is that the moment a leader takes their primary focus off of Asian affairs, off of China, off of Japan, off of the Pacific Ocean, sort of like a pendulum naturally swinging back, the Russian bureaucracy and the Russian state, the Russian leadership began thinking more about Europe, because that's their natural that's their natural point of orientation. And so it's created over the past couple hundred years of history a pendulum-esque swing, except that the pendulum metaphor is actually too regular and too predictable. It's an even it's like a jerky pendulum that Russia jerks towards Asia in a spasm of enthusiasm and then loses focus and is yanked back to focus on Europe by the strength and the inertia of the Russian bureaucracy and the Russian logistical system. And so that's why you have this back and forth motion. And I think the really surprising thing that emerged from this book is that although it might seem sort of obvious that Russia's interests are primarily in Europe, if you look at a map of the Russian population, most of the population lives within a couple hundred miles of European borders. All of Russia's history, most of Russia's trade, even today, despite all the conversations about trade with China, all that is focused on Europe. So it might seem obvious that Russia would want to devote its attention to Europe, but there is this repeated historical trend of Russian leaders thinking, this time is different. This time, I, the Tsar, I, the General Secretary, I, the President of Russia, can score a new success in Asia and achieve what my predecessors failed to achieve. And I think this repeated sense of overoptimism is absolutely crucial for understanding why Russia keeps trying again to play a major role in Asia, even though the historical track record is actually as much a track record of failure as it is a track record of success.
So Russia's multiple pivots to Asia, upon reading your book, kind of reminds me of another pivot to Asia. And I'm using that term deliberately, namely the long-running effort by the United States over the past decade or so to shift its attention to the Asia-Pacific region. Is there anything from the Russian experience that might help to explain why America's pivot to Asia sometimes seems so difficult?
Well, I think one of the things that's striking when you look at countries' foreign policies over the long durée is the extent to which the individual actions of leaders often begin to fall from the foreground and these broader structural factors begin to play a larger role. And obviously individuals can have a huge influence on the course of history, but nevertheless, it does seem like the natural orientations of bureaucracies, the intellectual assumptions that elite groups start with do have a really strong influence on what it is possible to accomplish if you're a leader. And I think one of the challenges of leaders of any country is that, particularly if you're an autocratic leader that has a fair amount of personal power, you can get a certain thing accomplished while you're focusing on it. But the moment you turn your focus away, the bureaucracy, the security services, the military revert to their preferred way of business. And that's certainly how the Russian experience has looked over the past couple of centuries. And I think when you look at the United States today, vis-a-vis the Asia-Pacific region, it's perfectly possible for secretaries of state to issue grand strategy documents, but actually a substantial portion of foreign policy is in the implementation. And implementation is done by bureaucracies, it's done by institutions, it's done by elites that shift over time. And it's only so possible to move these institutions in the time that any given leader is in power. Institutions always move slowly. And it seems like one of the dilemmas the United States has faced is that although it's possible to say we're going to prioritize our affairs in Asia, in fact, the U.S. from a foreign policy perspective has interests in Europe and the Middle East and all over the rest of the world. And so whatever the strategy document says and whatever the speech of the Secretary of State says, the reality is that the ship of state turns very slowly, and often the bureaucracies in question are just waiting for the leader in charge to circulate out and have a new leader with a different focus come into power. And so in that sense, I think there is a fair amount of similarity between the difficulties that the czars faced in getting their country to focus more on ties with Asia, and the difficulty that American secretaries of state have faced in terms of the gap between their promise to focus on Asia at the start of their time in office and the reality as to where they actually spend their time and spend their political capital while they're in office.
So I'd like to, for the last question, I'd like to pivot back to Russia and Russia's attitude towards the Far East now. And what's happened in the region since you published the book? I remember there were protests in the region last year and early this year, though I believe nothing substantial came of them. But I guess, kind of, what is Russia's current attitude towards the Far East?
Well, if you look solely at Russia's relationship with China, which is the most important of Russia's relations in the region today, at least on paper, Russia has an excellent relationship with China. Xi Jinping has referred to Vladimir Putin as his best friend. That's a direct quote. They've celebrated birthdays together. So there's great interest in both Beijing and in Moscow in playing up the depth of the relationship between those two countries today. But if you zoom out from the particulars of that relationship, and in particular, if you zoom out from the theatrics of that relationship, which I think are a really substantial part of what's actually going on, what you'll find is that although Vladimir Putin has for almost a decade now talked about a turn to the east, which is the current phraseology used by the Russian government, talked about reasserting Russia's position in Asia, making Russia a power across greater Eurasia. In fact, when you look at the deeper drivers, I think you find much less change than the Russian government would like to have us think. I'll give you a couple examples. One, if you look at how Russia's interacted with other powers in Asia, excluding China, what you'll find is actually that there hasn't been much increase in diplomatic relations, much increase in trade, much increase in Russian influence, whether it's Mongolia, either North or South Korea, Japan as well. So in some ways, the Russian turn to the east, as they like to describe it today, has actually been a turn just towards China. So less substantive in some ways than the rhetoric might suggest. But I think more important actually over the long run than that is when you look at the Russian Far East itself, the Far Eastern territories in Russia. And there what you find is although there are really substantial cities in Russia that are due north of Beijing, for example, in fact, the populace of this region remains resolutely focused on the European portions of Russia. We've actually seen a really substantial decline in the population of the Russian Far East over the past couple of decades, in part because people are actually moving to Western and Southern Russia. So there's actually been a population shift out of the Russian Far East. And those who have stayed in the Far East have in no ways reconceptualized their identity as being Asian at all. In fact, quite the opposite. There's concern about that type of identity and concern about Asian settlement, whether it's Chinese or from other countries in Asia, in Russia. Probably not very warranted given that the numbers are quite small, but nevertheless, that concern is real. And although the Russian government is very keen to talk about its friendship with China and other countries in Asia, you don't have to dig very deeply beyond the surface to find that many other political leaders, when they're talking off the record or not speaking for the government, have a much different and much more skeptical view of their Asian neighbors. And in particular, the popular view remains really quite skeptical of closer ties with countries in Asia, in particular in China. And so it does seem to me that if you look on the ground in the Russian Far East, you'll find very little evidence of the turn to the East that Putin talks about in his speeches at all, other than a couple of new infrastructure projects, a couple of bridges built, a university renovated. There's really not a lot of substance to the turn to the East. And in fact, I would say something of the opposite, that the Russian Far East now more than at any point in the past three decades since the collapse of the Soviet Union is more focused on European Russia than ever before. And so I think this too bodes poorly for the long-term impact of Putin's turn to the East, because when you look at how Russia itself is governed, how Russians themselves are thinking, what you'll find is that although polling suggests that many Russians see China as one of their closest partners in the international stage, in fact, when you scratch a little bit deeper, you find much more skepticism than those headlines suggest. And I think that whenever it is that the Putin regime begins to leave the scene, whether with Putin's death at some point or in whatever other fashion, whenever we have a new period of political competition in Russia, it will be very easy for one group, one faction to play up on anti-China sentiment as a means of winning votes and winning support from the Russian populace. And we already see this to a certain extent with the anti-Putin opposition in Russia, focusing on China and on migration from Asian countries is a very popular a theme among the Russian populace. And so it does seem like there's a reservoir of popular skepticism about Asia that is just waiting to be tapped into by a politician looking for support. And so when you put all that together, I think the depths of this pivot do look like they're not nearly as deep as Putin would like. And in many ways, like the previous pivots that Russia has made to Asia under the Soviets, under the Tsars, they're heavy on rhetoric, heavy on formal statements, and lighter on the bigger social and institutional and military changes that you would need in order to assert Russian power in Asia over a longer duration.
So with that, thank you for listening to an interview with Professor Chris Miller, author of We Shall Be Masters, Russian Pivots to East Asia from Peter the Great to Putin. Chris, I actually have one more question for you. What's next for you, and where can people find your work?
Well, I'm working now on a new book on the political history of the computer chip, which might sound like a departure, but it actually emerges from my study of Cold War military technology. And both in the U.S. and the Soviet Union in the 1950s and 60s, there was tremendous investment in microelectronics. And it's not widely known, but just two or three years after the first integrated circuit, rather, was invented in the United States, the Soviet Union, independently of the U.S., invented its own integrated circuit and tried to plug it into all sorts of military and space systems. So I'm trying to trace the history of chips from their invention in the Cold War all the way up to the contemporary debate about semiconductor shortages and their impact on U.S. China economic issues and military competition as well. So it's a story that again will have a broad geographic arc from Europe all the way across Russia and ending in Asia.
So that sounds like a book that is extremely well timed for the moment. But you can find me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at @NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at @BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews, plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. You can find us on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Please subscribe. Please continue listening. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends if you want to continue to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned to learn more about who's coming up on the show. But before then, thank you so much, Chris, for joining me today.
Thanks so much for the invitation.